the headlines. Press TV sources say Iran rejects excessive demands by Europeans and the U.S. to destroy its advanced centrifuges in return for a temporary suspension of some nuclear sanctions. Scotland votes in a first post-Brexit election that has the potential to rock the United Kingdom over a new independence referendum. And also in our headlines, Greek labor unions shut down the civil service for a new round of strikes and protests over a controversial labor reform. Hello and welcome, everybody. Press TV has learned that Iran will not accept new demands raised by the United States and the European signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal, also known as the JCPOA. The new American and European demands apparently include the destruction of Iran's advanced centrifuges in return for the temporary suspension of some JCPOA-related sanctions. Sources say the demands are against the JCPOA that calls for the stockpiling of those centrifuges, including IR-4, IR-6, and IR-9 under the supervision of the International Atomic Energy Agency. Press TV has also learned that there is high probability the nuclear deal as well as Vienna talks to revive the agreement will fail if the West insists on its excessive demands. Sources say the new demands come as Washington has so far failed to remove all JCPOA-related sanctions. Political analyst Heinz Gertner says there have been several attempts so far to derail the Vienna talks between Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal.
There have been several attempts here now and during these talks to derail the diplomacy, which did not work. So the delegations continued with their agenda. Having said this, of course, technical issues are not easy to solve. Iran made advances in its technology, especially concerning the centrifuges, but also the sanctions advanced. So there has to be a balance between the reduction of sanctions and Iran's nuclear technology. And at the end, there has to be a compromise. So no side will get what it wanted in the first place. So the goal should be to restore the situation of 2015. So that does not necessarily mean the same technology as 2015. It doesn't necessarily mean the sanction situation of 2015. But it means that the political and technical conditions have to be restored.
Iran is marking the 41st anniversary of a notorious attack and hostage-taking incident at the Iranian embassy in the UK. The hostage-taking in 1980 resulted in the deaths of two embassy staff. But years on after the incident, questions remain about the UK government's handling of the siege.
May 5th marked the anniversary of a six-day Iranian embassy siege in the United Kingdom. The hostage-taking took place from April 30th to May 5th, 1980, after a group of six armed men stormed the Iranian embassy in London. The gunmen were members of a separatist terror group. They took 26 people hostage, including embassy staff, several visitors, and a police officer who had been guarding the embassy. They demanded the release of prisoners in Khuzestan and their own safe passage out of the United Kingdom. Police negotiators secured the release of five hostages in exchange for minor concessions, such as a broadcasting of the hostage takers' demands on British television. By the sixth day of the siege, the gunmen were increasingly frustrated at the lack of progress in meeting their demands. That evening, they killed Sayed Abbas Lavosani, an Iranian national working for the press department of the embassy, and threw his body out. The Special Air Services, or SAS, the Special Forces Regiment of the British Army, then initiated an operation to rescue the remaining hostages, abseiling through the roof and forcing entry through the windows. During the 17-minute raid, all the living hostages were rescued but one, and five of the six hostage takers were killed. Many argued that the killing of hostage takers by SAS was a deliberate act to hide what was actually behind the siege.
Well, I think you can make that charge. I think it's really peculiar that you can kill just about everyone, and then dead men tell no tales. I think that it's a situation that bears further investigation.
The hostage taking happened just days after the Iranian embassy in London had sent a letter to the UK Foreign Secretary demanding the British government guarantee the security of the embassy building.
Well, my take is that it's very peculiar with the timing. The fact that the hostage takers traveled to Britain on Iraqi passports and would come home late at night to the apartment they rented drunk with prostitutes. So I don't think they seem to be quite the squeaky clean freedom fighters they made themselves out to be. I think there is some peculiar background to this, especially since they picked up the weapons in Britain that some people have suggested came in someone's diplomatic bag. So again, that has something to be investigated and should be looked at more closely and carefully.
A parliamentary court voted that the sole hostage taker would get a life sentence. The jail term, though, was reduced to 28 years. The man, however, was released in 2008 and is living under the covert protection of the British government. The court also cleared the SAS of any wrongdoing.
Some facts related to this incident. The siege took place by three armed men who held 20 people hostage. They were opposed to Imam Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic Republic. Their demand, the release of 91 prisoners from Iran. At the end, one gunman survived. He was given a life sentence in 1981, then released in 2008. It's reported that he's living under the covert protection of the British government.
The clearance of SAS of any wrongdoing by the British court came as the UK government even praised the special forces in their embassy response. Many argue that the siege must have ended without any of the hostage takers being killed by SAS. An independent probe team also found that the SAS operation was illegal. New Zealander director Toa Fraser also directed a movie called 6 Days, in which a new narrative was provided and the whole story was distorted.
Well, the fact that it was Maggie Thatcher's government doing this, and Maggie Thatcher was a hardliner, and she was unable to use the police to effect an end to the siege and would not provide even some of the simplest demands that the hostage takers wanted, indicates an over-reliance on the armed forces, which she loved to do, such as in the Falklands War, which was entirely unnecessary and illegal.
The 41st anniversary of the embassy siege in the UK comes as Iranian embassies around the globe have come under attacks for over 30 times since the Islamic Revolution in 1979. Iranian embassies in Canada, Australia, Germany, Denmark, Netherlands, Norway, Sweden, United Kingdom, Afghanistan, Libya, and many other countries have come under such attacks. All these have been blamed on the likes of the Mujahideen Khalq terrorist group, which has enjoyed direct and indirect support from the West, including the United States and Britain.
Well, I think that's right. The MEK are dangerous people that bought their way off a terrorist list by bribing American politicians such as John Bolton and Hillary Clinton, who have been Secretary of State in the past. So I think that they are a terrorist group, should be treated as such, and not seen as some kind of a freedom-fighting group and democracy lovers that need to be coddled.
Iran's Western adversaries stand accused of adopting double standards when it comes to the issue of terrorism. And critics of this approach say the West actually divides terrorists into good and bad ones, treating those serving its own interests, like the MKO, as good terrorists.
Palestinians have gathered in occupied East Jerusalem al-Quds to protest against the Israeli regime's new eviction order for inhabitants in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. Troops clashed with protesters and used water cannons to disperse them. The Palestinian Red Crescent said Israeli forces arrested near a dozen protesters. It said more than 20 protesters were also injured. This was the fourth consecutive night of protests against the expulsion order for Palestinians. An Israeli court ruled that over a dozen Palestinian families must leave their homes by Saturday, despite having lived in Sheikh Jarrah for generations. Palestinians see the move as part of Israel's land grab policy to expand its settlements and change the demographic character of Jerusalem al-Quds. Palestinians have held an event in the Gaza Strip to hail regional and international support for resistance groups in the besieged enclave. The event was organized by the Imam Khomeini Relief Committee, just days ahead of the International Quds Day. Ruba Shabit reports from Gaza.
Just days ahead of the International Quds Day, Imam Khomeini Relief Committee organized an event in Gaza, which took place at a military site belonging to Palestinian resistance group Al-Mujahideen Brigades. Resistance groups participating in the event held regional and international supports for the Palestinian resistance.
We thank all the efforts that are made to support the Palestinian cause in general and the Palestinian resistance in specific. We stress that these attempts to stand by the Palestinian resistance won't go in vain, as the resistance is improving its capabilities to defend Palestine and Jerusalem al-Quds.
During the event, Al-Mujahideen Brigades expressed gratitude to all the countries who support the Palestinians against the Israeli regime, on top of which is the Islamic Republic of Iran that officially initiated the International Quds Day by its late founder Imam Khomeini in 1979.
On the International Quds Day, all Palestinians and Muslims all over the world make Jerusalem al-Quds their main destination for its significant historical and religious symbolism. The resistance men are here to say that we are supporting our people in al-Quds, and we are ready to fight with you. We also appreciate all the efforts made by the Islamic Republic of Iran and all the supporters of the resistance in the face of Israeli occupation.
The International Quds Day is considered a significant day to draw the world's attention to the Israeli crimes against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and the besieged Gaza Strip. Palestinian groups participating in the event held supports for Palestinians, adding the more they hold events like this, the more they draw attention to the Israeli crimes against Palestinians. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
Unions in Greece have held rallies over government's labor reform plans that could see an increase in working hours. Demonstrators gathered in the capital, Athens, as well as other major cities to voice their opposition to the proposal. Unions have also gone on strike, shutting down civil services, sidelining ferries, and halting most public transport in Athens except for buses. Several flights have also been canceled due to a work stoppage by air traffic controllers. This as the second such strike by unions in a week. The government is debating a draft law to extend working hours from the current 40 hours a week. People in Scotland are voting for a new parliament, results of which could impact on whether or not there is a second referendum on the region's independence from the UK. Some 4.3 million Scots have registered to cast their ballots. The pro-independence Scottish National Party, SNP, is seeking a majority in 129-member parliament. Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon has already pledged to call another independence vote if her party gets a clear mandate. On Tuesday, she challenged British Prime Minister Boris Johnson to take the matter to court if he wants to prevent another referendum in Scotland. In 2014, Scots voted by 55% to 45% to stay in the UK, but the public opinion has changed gradually after Brexit. Our correspondent in Edinburgh, Saeed Puraza, says economic recovery and the possibility of a second referendum on independence are the most important issues for voters.
So those two questions are really on the minds of the voters today. Who is going to lead Scotland out of the economic state that it is in, brought on by the pandemic, as well as whether or not there should be a second referendum later on? The SNP has promised a referendum if it wins a majority, indeed, in today's election, when the pandemic is over, right about the end of the year 2023. A lot of the voters, 16 and above, have already cast their ballots, have chosen the mail-in system or the postal vote. But assuming that the SNP wins the majority in this election, then they're going to go ahead and carry out those plans. If they don't, then there's a possibility of a coalition being formed. If that were to pass, if they secure a majority, call a second referendum, then there will be the barrier of getting the approval, the blessing of the UK Prime Minister, of Westminster, Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who has already ruled out any of that happening, saying calling for a second referendum at this point in time is irresponsible.
India has recorded the highest daily rise in COVID-19 cases in the country, as rather the country struggles to contain the deadly disease. According to the health ministry data, more than 412,000 people contracted the coronavirus in the past 24 hours. The total number of infections in the country has now surpassed 21 million. India also reported a record daily increase in its death toll by nearly 4,000. Coronavirus has surged in India in the past few weeks over a new variant. The country is now facing severe shortages of medicines and oxygen supplies. Several states are under localized lockdowns and curfews, but the government is reluctant to impose a national lockdown for fear of the impact on the economy. Our correspondent in New Delhi, Munawar Zaman, says India's healthcare system has collapsed and cannot deal with a huge number of patients.
So this is the second wave, and it is dangerous and deadly. But today we're getting reports that the third wave is inevitable and it will be followed right away after the second wave. I'm not saying this. This is the scientific advisor to the government of India, who has warned that the third wave is inevitable and it's going to be more deadlier and more tragic than the one we are facing. Now the country is facing a tremendous pressure for a complete lockdown or a national or a nationwide curfew for at least couple or 3 weeks to at least break the transmission chain. Today's grim picture is a wake-up call. We see more than 4,000 deaths. I mean, it is absolutely chaotic, and more than 400,000 cases, which is totally out of control, and the healthcare system has collapsed. Even the foreign ministry spokesperson spoke about the healthcare system yesterday. He was not short of blaming the past governments, but he also acknowledged that the healthcare system in India has completely collapsed.
And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
قضیه فلسطین از یادان نخواهد رفت و شهر مقدس بیت المقدس پایتخت فلسطین باقی خواهد ماند و قبله اول مسلمان ها برای مسلمان ها باقی خواهد ماند.
The issue of occupied Palestine will never be forgotten. The holy city of Beit al-Muqaddas will remain forever the capital of Palestine. And the first Qibla of Muslims will always be there for Muslims. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
People who limit the Quran to worshipping and personal matters haven't understood it. This is a part of a speech delivered on April 14, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, at the annual Ramadan Quranic meeting. The speech was delivered via video conference with the participation of a number of prominent Quranic reciters.
Allah the Exalted Himself teaches us how to speak to Him. So, from the beginning, in the name of Allah the Beneficent, the Merciful, to the end it guides, shows the straight path, the path of those on whom you have bestowed your grace. The Holy Quran, chapter 1, verse 6 to 7. The straight path is the path of those people on whom God has bestowed His grace. They are people who did not deviate from the straight path and who did not provoke the wrath of God. Also in the beginning of Surah Al-Baqarah, God speaks of Quranic guidance. Alif Lam Mim. This is the book, in it is sure guidance, without doubt, to the Muttaqeen. Chapter 2, verse 1 to 2. Therefore, the Quran begins with Quranic guidance, and there are many other parts as well, tens of other ayahs, when God speaks of Quranic guidance and assistance.
يا خير زاد رمضان يا شهر القرآن فيك أذوق حلاوة الإيمان لا لا تنقضي أنت للروح دواء رمضان 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 ليتك دوما قريب
And Quranic guidance is not particular to a special group. The Quran is addressed to all of humanity. It claims that it wants to guide all humans towards the straight path and the correct lifestyle which will lead to the correct destination. This is no less than a message to all the worlds. The Holy Quran, chapter 38, verse 87. Well, there is a fundamental point here. Quranic guidance is not confined to a particular area of human life. Rather, it covers the whole sphere of human life. In other words, it is not the case that the Quran guides us in one part of life, but leaves us alone and adopts an indifferent approach in any other essential area of life.
الحمد لله الحمد لله All praises to Allah All praises to Allah الحمد لله الحمد لله All praises to Allah All praises to Allah.
American politician and lawyer Elliot Abrams, who has served in a number of U.S. administrations, has proposed to improve American foreign policy. In an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, Abrams argued that the U.S. is at a critical crossroads when it comes to the defense of American freedom, security, and prosperity. Abrams says around the world, the U.S. faces significant national security threats, among them revisionist powers, the spread of nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons, and transnational terrorism, which are all made more dangerous by renewed great power competition with China. Abrams believed none of those challenges will disappear if America abandons the international role it has maintained since World War II as what he called the superpower leader of the free world. Abrams also says that is why he is joining with 75 other national security scholars and practitioners to launch the Vandenberg Coalition, a new network committed to advancing what has been described as a strong and proud American foreign policy. But what is this war party and what purpose does it serve?
We will eliminate all of these people with this dual loyalty, like Elliot Abrams. Elliot Abrams is the son of Norman Podoretz, a son-in-law of Norman Podoretz and Mitch Decker, a classic neocon, a man who's willing to break the laws of the United States of America in the interest of Israel. He had to get a pardon in order to get his job, his security clearance. We need to have a clear dividing line here between the people who serve Israel, like Elliot Abrams, who serve Israel's interests, and the people who serve America's interests.
Many believe this sounds more like the project for the new American century. PNAC, which was active between the years of 1997 and 2006, was a new conservative think tank whose goal was to promote American global leadership. The group openly advocated for total global military domination, and many PNAC members held highest level positions in the George W. Bush administration.
Yes, that's exactly what it is. Nothing has changed except the labels. These people were, for some reason, they didn't like Donald Trump. I don't understand this. He did everything that Israel wanted. But the problem here is that these people are always using front groups. They're always trying to disguise themselves as an American this or Republican that or conservative this. All of these labels are covers. They're disguises for the fact that these are Jews pursuing Jewish interests. This interest of the state of Israel and not the interest of the United States of America.
Elliot Abrams' proposal comes as the United States has already been actively engaged in multiple confrontations in the Middle East and East Asia. It's now a decades-long war on countries like Afghanistan and Iraq, and even Syria have led to nothing but deaths and destruction. The wars cost America trillions of dollars. However, numerous military manufacturers, including Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, and Northrop Grumman, have large contributions to U.S. wars by profiting the most from them. This is why growing arms investments mean a lot for international relations. Many believe this may be the reason behind the creation of the project suggested by Abrams. Meanwhile, Washington has been at a trade war with China for some years. It has also been initiating a potential altercation by keeping its presence in the South China Sea and other areas in the region. It seems that such comments by the likes of Abrams only serve the U.S. military manufacturers and the deep state, which support forever wars, as opposed to the policy of the new administration of President Joe Biden.
But if you're talking about America, America's interest, you're disguising once again the fact that this is Israel's interest, these are Jewish interests. And yeah, there is a military industrial complex that profits from wars, that's true. But that all disguises the fact that what Elliot Abrams really represented here. So as I said at the beginning, I think this is a good idea. I think they should form a Jewish party. If you want Jewish interests, if you want America to serve Jewish interests, then vote for Elliot Abrams and all of his formerly known as neoconservative friends.
Biden's reluctance to continue down the path of neocons and other warmongers in the U.S. ruling establishment aside, the U.S. is practically unable to keep going down that road. On the other hand, multiple U.S. wars waged over the past decades indicate that the United States is a warning power, as it has not won any of them. yet Washington wants to continue its wars and its costs. Most observers, strategists, and political scientists, as well as sitting and former officials in the U.S. and the wider West, believe that America's clout has long been under decline and the country is no longer capable of acting like the good cop it has portrayed itself to be.
New allegations are swirling around British Prime Minister Boris Johnson about misusing funds received from Conservative Party donations. The Prime Minister stands accused of infringing the law by using the funds to renovate his residence at No. 11 Downing Street. The allegation has prompted an Electoral Commission probe into the matter, which can take months to complete. Johnson maintains that he has personally paid for the costs of the renovation.
Who initially, and Prime Minister, initially is the key word here, who initially paid for the redecoration of his Downing Street flat?
As for the latest stuff that he's bringing up, he should know that I've paid for Downing Street refurbishment personally, Mr. Speaker, and I contrast it. Any further declaration that I have to make, I will, I will be advised upon by Lord Guy.
However, the British Prime Minister did not clarify whether he initially made the payments.
Well, if any of the three reviews into his conduct find that he broke the ministerial code, then Johnson would be expected to resign, but just expected, is how it says. But the code has already proved useless, really, like in the case of Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon, but she did a lot worse. But really, I don't think the Electoral Commission, which is investigating, it's conducting at least one of the investigations, will really want to bring down the leader of an elected government with a large majority.
The latest allegation, which is referred to by the British media as the sleaze row, comes only days before local elections across the country are scheduled to be held. A recent opinion poll now shows the ruling Conservatives are losing their lead over the opposition Labour Party. Apart from the redecoration scandal, there have been other unconfirmed reports that the Conservative Party donors have been solicited funds for personal matters. The Sunday Times has cited a British MP as saying that he had received a complaint from a donor who was asked to pay for Boris Johnson's child's nanny. A spokesperson for the Prime Minister's office dismissed the report, saying Johnson had paid all the childcare costs himself, but she didn't respond to a question about who had initially made the payment. But that's not the only report tarnishing the Prime Minister's image. He's recently being grilled about whether or not he had said he would rather see bodies piled up in their thousands than declare another nationwide lockdown, remarks he flatly rejects ever making.
Prime Minister.
No, Mr. Speaker, and I think the Right Honourable Gentleman is a lawyer, I'm given to understand. I think that if he's going to repeat allegations like that, he should come to this House and substantiate those allegations and say where he heard them and who exactly is supposed to have said those. Who exactly is supposed to have said those things, Mr. Speaker? Because what I certainly can tell him, and he asked about the October decisions, they were very bitter.
The rules on parliamentarians' expenses were really tightened up more than 10 years ago, and a few MPs were forced to resign over that. But that means that a lot of the Westminster sleaze that we used to talk about all the time has been eliminated. I think the reason that this has become such a big issue is that the Labour Party opposition doesn't have any clear policies or even really broad politics.
Tories are now debating who's behind the leaks, with the majority of fingers now pointing at former aide to the Prime Minister, Dominic Cummins. In the meantime, the opposition Labour Party has accused the government of showing contempt against the British people by engaging in such infightings.
An audit by the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, has revealed that Washington's effort in February 2019 to send aid to Venezuela was part of a plot to change the legitimate government of President Nicolas Maduro in the oil-rich Latin American country. The USAID report noted that the aid offer was not planned in alignment with humanitarian principles, but for supporting pro-Western figure Juan Guaido. That is while Venezuela was grappling with chronic shortages of food and medicine. The document said materials sent to the Colombian border region in February 2019 were planned to be distributed by the allies of Venezuelan opposition figure Juan Guaido to reinforce his credibility. The U.S. administration, under the former President Donald Trump, planned for the aid supplies to be carried out by Guaido's allies across the Colombian border into Venezuela. However, the Venezuelan government blocked the aid convoys at the time, calling the U.S. move a violation of the country's sovereignty. In reaction to the audit, the Venezuelan Foreign Minister Jorge Arreaza said the U.S. offered aid to the oil-rich nation 2 years ago in a bid to overthrow the government in Caracas. Also, the Venezuelan Information Minister Freddy Nunez called the so-called U.S. humanitarian support an excuse in which Washington sought to break Venezuela's territorial sovereignty. Venezuela descended into political turmoil after opposition figure Juan Guaido unilaterally declared himself as the interim president in January 2019. He claimed Maduro's re-election in 2018 was fraudulent. The Trump administration recognized Guaido as the legitimate leader of Venezuela and publicly pursued a regime change policy against Maduro. Meanwhile, the Biden administration has reaffirmed the U.S. recognition of Guaido as the interim president and has ruled out negotiations with Maduro anytime soon. Washington has been pursuing a regime change in Venezuela and has imposed crippling sanctions on the country to force Maduro out of power. The organization USAID has been accused of political interference in the past. It has used aid and the notion of democracy promotion to interfere in countries like Russia and Cuba. Venezuela has been no exception.
Well, I would say yes, the U.S. does lose credibility when its plans get exposed, but that won't deter the United States from trying to push forward these plans. Really, what we have in the U.S. is there's one end goal, one end and interest, and that interest is in the interest of imperialism, of trying to open up markets and take resources from other nations that the U.S. either does not have enough of or would want to have more of. You know, one of those resources in terms of Venezuela being oil.
The U.S. has been after regime change in Venezuela for quite some time, especially during the presidency of the former president Hugo Chavez, who was very vociferous in its anti-U.S. stance. The U.S. has refrained from recognizing Nicolas Maduro's re-election in 2018, freezing millions of dollars of Venezuelan money in U.S. bank accounts, and imposing sanctions on the crisis of the economy of the Latin American nation. What has been termed as economic terrorism, Washington is attempting to use sanctions as a leverage to overthrow the legitimate government of Maduro. Last month, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro slammed Washington's plan to transfer $150 million of the country's frozen funds from offshore accounts to the opposition led by Juan Guaido. Maduro lashed out at both the U.S. government and the Venezuelan opposition, calling them a pile of gangster bandits. While freezing assets and slapping illegal sanctions on countries that refuse to submit to Washington's hegemonic policies is nothing new. The U.S. sanctions have directly targeted Venezuelan people who are stuck between the coronavirus pandemic and an economic crisis. There's also the case of the failed U.S.-backed coup plot. Venezuelan security forces arrested dozens of people, including two Americans, after a beach invasion allegedly aimed to overthrow President Nicolas Maduro. This was a plot which involved U.S.-backed opposition leader Juan Guaido. A Florida-based ex-Green Beret, Jordan Goodreau, told the Associated Press that he was working with the two American men in a mission launched early to liberate Venezuela.
I would point out that a lot of these failures are contemporary. They're things that are happening recently, and not to say that they weren't failures in the past, but we've seen how a lot of the regime change efforts in the past were far more successful than they have been recently. I think part of the problem for the United States, at least, is that the world is becoming a lot stronger and a lot more aware of some of the tactics that the United States is using.
Like other countries in South America, Venezuela is facing a harsh new pandemic wave, fueled by more infectious virus variants coming from neighboring Brazil. Experts say the sanctions, used as a tool for regime change, have no effect on the stability of the Maduro administration, but impact the socioeconomic condition of ordinary people amidst the COVID-19 crisis.
The first Palestinian national election in 15 years has been indefinitely delayed. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas made the announcement following a meeting with Ramallah-based political factions on Thursday. Abbas blamed Israel and the uncertainty about whether it would allow the vote to take place in the occupied West Bank and Gaza for the decision.
Facing this difficult situation, we decided to postpone the date of holding legislative elections until the participation of Jerusalem and its people is guaranteed. Jerusalem will not be compromised, and our people in Jerusalem will not give up their right to exercise their democratic rights.
The decision came 3 months after he issued a formal decree ordering a vote for the Palestinian legislature on May 22nd and a Palestinian presidential election on July 31st, votes that could serve as an acid test for the legitimacy of the Palestinian political institutions, including his own presidency. Many observers believe the indefinite postponement is effectively a cancellation of the vote.
In my opinion, the best thing the Palestinian Authority can do is to dissolve itself. Anyone who tries to represent Palestinians today is compromised in some way, either because they are cooperating with the Israeli occupiers and oppressors, or because they can only operate if they're opposing them, as Hamas is. They can operate only within certain parameters because they're denied the ability to operate the way they would like to operate.
Hundreds of Palestinians staged a protest in Ramallah to denounce the decision. They chanted slogans calling for the formation of a legitimate government. Earlier in the day, hundreds of people had staged rallies in the Gaza Strip to condemn the Palestinian Authority chief's plans to call off the vote. The Palestinian resistance movement, Hamas, denounced Abbas's decision, calling it, quote, a coup. In a statement, Hamas said the move goes against the path of partnership and national consensus, issues that cannot be pawned as collateral for the agenda of a faction. It also noted that the Fatah movement and the Palestinian president bear full responsibility for the decision and its consequence. In a separate statement, head of Hamas Political Bureau, Ismail Haniyeh, condemned as unconvincing the decision, demanding that the elections of the Legislative Council, the Palestinian Authority, and the National Council be held at agreed schedules. He added that the resistance movement is ready to cooperate with all Palestinian political factions.
A Hamas win might be satisfying to many. It might be satisfying in the sense that it confronts Israel and that it stands up for Palestinian rights. But in fact, a Hamas win means probably more oppression and less opportunity from the Israeli side, and it very possibly will be used as a pretext for Israel to be even more oppressive and to accelerate their genocide and ethnic cleansing of Palestine, because their ultimate objective is to have no Palestinians in Palestine.
Israeli authorities have made many efforts to either cancel or postpone the polls. Israeli forces have escalated an arrest campaign targeting key Hamas figures in the West Bank in recent months. Observers are drawing a parallel between the recent arrests and those made in the run-up to the 2006 elections, which resulted in a sweeping victory for Hamas.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Proper Nutrition with Brother Sayyid Vahid Alavi. in the program The Month of Allah.
Assalamu alaikum everyone, this is Sayyid Wahid and welcome to the month of Allah once again. Now, this time I want to talk about 20 nutrition etiquettes for the month of Allah, Shahrul Ramadan. Number one, use high fiber foods. Why? And what kind of fiber foods are we talking about? These foods include fruits, vegetables, beans and whole grains. The reason is that they are nutritious, they are relatively low in calories, they provide 30 to 20 grams of fiber needed per day, and they digest slowly, and that is very good when you are fasting. So they have less effect on the insulin and blood glucose. It also has vitamin C and vitamin B and FE vitamins. In your food or iftar or in your sahari, the food that you eat when you wake up before fasting, put vegetables and a lot of it. Yellow and orange vegetables in your diet is a must, like broccoli, carrot and lemon. This group has something called antioxidants, all right? Antioxidants that are very important for protecting the body against cancer and other diseases. It is advisable to eat between 3 to 4 pounds per day of fruit and vegetables. Number three, try to reduce sugar and refined carbohydrates, such as white bread, salt, sugar, and everything that is white. Try to avoid that. As well as salty, greasy snacks and spicy seasonings. Reduce your sugar and refined carbohydrates, such as white bread, salt, and you have salty, greasy snacks and spicy seasonings. Many sweet food items have a lot of fat, so they carry a lot of calories to the body, so you should try to avoid that too, especially when you are fasting. Number four, do not eat animal fat because they have saturated fat, which increases the amount of blood cholesterol and has a lot of health hazards. Use instead lean meat, low fat or non-fat chicken and dairy products. I hope that you enjoyed the program for this time and please join us in future programs. Till this, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon all of you. Ramadan Kareem. وموعظة ونور فيه شفاء للصدور وشفيعنا يوم النشور آياته تروي المدى وصفاته نبع الهدى نلقى الجنان بحبه لن تستقيم حياتنا إلا به هو القرآن والفرقان إليه تنصت الأكوان وفيه تعطر الآذان والقرآن
Communicate.
The Brereton Report, released in late 2020, documents alleged war crimes committed by Australian Special Forces in Afghanistan. An inquiry into war crimes committed there by British Special Forces as well was also concluded just a few months earlier with many similarities. This is a topic that is often overlooked and underreported, especially given the severity of the crimes. Let's take a closer look at what we learned from these inquiries. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. In 2001, Australia invaded Afghanistan along with the United States and the United Kingdom. 20 years later, these countries are still occupying Afghanistan after promising they would bring peace and stability. Stupendous amounts of money, resources, and manpower have gone towards this occupation, all in the name of nation building. And as it turns out, a lot of these resources have been used to commit horrific acts against the people of Afghanistan. In late 2020, an inquiry into war crimes committed by Australian Special Forces in Afghanistan was finally released. This 465-page report, titled The Brereton Report, was initiated in 2016 and took several years to complete. The report found that 39 Afghan civilians were alleged to have been unlawfully killed by or involving Australian Defence Force members. None of these alleged crimes took place in the heat of battle, and the victims were non-combatants or no longer combatants. The report is broken down into three parts. However, a lot of it is heavily redacted. Not just the names of individuals, but in some cases, entire events are redacted. One of the shocking practices revealed in this report is known as blooding. This practice is another extremely disturbing aspect of these war crimes. Essentially, what would happen is you'd have a platoon commander who would take a new squad member and have them execute a detained prisoner. The prisoner would be unarmed, in cuffs, and posing no threat whatsoever. The term used in this report is also of interest because they referred to this as an unlawful killing. What it really is an execution. It's cold-blooded murder. Calling it an unlawful killing is just a way to water down the horror of what we're discussing here. But you can't do that. What we're talking about here are war crimes. We're talking about murder. There is no way to sugarcoat atrocities like this. Another practice that we're also made aware of is throwdowns. Basically, what this means is that special forces would carry weapons that are not regularly issued by the Australian or British military and then plant them on a prisoner after executing them. They would throw it down on the ground next to them, a throwdown. This would make it look like the prisoner wasn't executed, but instead killed during a firefight or because they had supposedly pulled a knife, for example. None of which was true, of course. It's important to note that the Brereton Report is not in fact a criminal investigation, but an inquiry conducted by the Inspector General of the Australian Defence Force. This is a role that is separate from the chain of command in the Australian Armed Forces and is appointed by the Secretary of Defence. The Brereton Report makes a number of recommendations following the inquiry, some criminal, others promotions, others pardons. However, it's not clear which cases they're referring to because a lot of it has been redacted. Again, another war crime which didn't come from the Brereton Report but is still one of the most striking nonetheless is a video that was released by Four Corners. It shows three men from the Australian SAS chasing an Afghan farmer with a German shepherd. They catch up to him and gather around him as he is lying on the ground. At one point, one of the SAS can be heard asking if he should drop the man. There's an inaudible answer, after which we see him execute the Afghan farmer at point-blank range using his machine gun. It's sickening, it's grotesque, and it's a war crime that makes someone feel physically ill just by watching it. The man who was executed in the video was 26 years old. His name was Dad Muhammad. They said later that he was carrying a radio, supposedly, and that this proved that he was an insurgent, and that's why they killed him. This turned out to be a lie. There was no radio recovered. And even if there was, one has to ask the question, how does carrying a radio merit an execution at point-blank range? After the release of the Brereton Report, a Chinese official posted a doctored image on Twitter of an Australian soldier with a knife in reference to the war crimes committed by their special forces. What's interesting here isn't so much the image, but the reaction it garnered, particularly from Australian officials. Australia's parliament was outraged by it, and Australia's prime minister issued a statement rebuking the Chinese government, demanding an apology. Apparently, the Australian government is more offended by people exposing and calling out its war crimes than the actual war crimes themselves perpetrated by its own soldiers. David McBride, a former lawyer and major in the Australian Defence Force, leaked evidence of war crimes to the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, ABC. After this happened, ABC's offices were raided by police. And I think it's extremely interesting and worth pointing out here that when supposedly liberal democracies like the United States, Australia, and the UK have embarrassing information about them leaked to the press, all notions of freedom of speech and press freedoms suddenly seem to go out the window. We saw this with the raid on ABC, with the persecution of Julian Assange, and numerous other whistleblowers across the years. After leaking evidence of war crimes committed by Australian Special Forces in Afghanistan to ABC, David McBride faces 5 charges, including those of theft of Commonwealth property, breaching the Defense Act, and disclosing information without due authorization. This could result in him going to jail for decades. He joins me now to talk more. Thanks for taking the time, David. It's good to have you on.
Thank you, Richard.
So, David, I want to start out with the prosecution that you're up against. You're facing several decades in jail now because you exposed war crimes committed by the SAS in Afghanistan. You detail how you tried going up the chain of command, and they put these roadblocks and obstacles in front of you. Can you maybe elaborate on some of the mechanisms that an institution like the Australian military, perhaps the British and the American military, might put in place to prevent whistleblowers like you from disclosing the truth and exposing wrongdoing?
It wasn't war crimes that I first noticed a problem. It was more that we didn't tell the truth about anything, about small things as well as big things. That the war looked like it was being run to win domestic elections rather than to actually make a difference in Afghanistan. And I started to get suspicious because when I made complaints, they weren't treated seriously. And in fact, the message that seemed to be coming back to me was, shut up, stop making waves, what's going on is way above your pay grade. And there were some things which looked like cold-blooded murders, but that weren't being investigated, or that were just being whitewashed. And I was like, well, how can that be? How can you not look into something which looks like children are being killed?
The Brereton report, which was concluded in late 2020, says the SAS killed 39 Afghan civilians. That's the official figure. How many of those special forces that committed these murders were prosecuted or held accountable? And do you think that figure of 39 casualties is legitimate? Do you think it's accurate?
There's only one person who ever put on a uniform for Australia who was facing a trial and significant jail time at this stage, and that is me. And I think even the government finds that an uncomfortable fact. The report, as you know, was only finished late in 2020, and it wasn't a conviction of anybody. It was simply a non-criminal report, like an inquiry, which recommended charges, didn't even recommend charges. It recommended the police look at those 39 matters and, if necessary, charge people. And the wheels of justice, even when they're sort of being totally run honestly, take a long time. And it's quite possible we won't even have a trial on this until 2030. In relation to the amount of murders, I don't know that it was that many more, but it's a significant number because it wasn't, a lot of people must have known. And that's why it's truly significant, because you'd say a lot of people must have known, a lot of people must have said nothing. And not only that, what is more worrying than, say, if it had been a 300, was that often we rewarded the perpetrators of the murders. We gave them medals. We made them sort of media superstars. And I think that's the really sickening thing to say. Who gets ahead in our society? You know, the person that does the right thing, or the person who is the most sneaky, the most ruthless, the person that actually thinks our laws are just a joke.
David, are you concerned about Australia's geopolitical standing, its place on the international stage? Because a lot of people seem to see it as doing the bidding of the United States.